Это у маликомио!
Вы хотите меня видеть?
Да, да. Идите в спортивные, в рабочие обидите и принесите мне На помощь! На помощь! Don't cry! Hold it back!
All that hate's gonna burn you up, kid.
Keep some warm.
You want blindfolds? This fire is a Geneva Convention. I never heard of it.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Hopefully this will be working. This is the Armory with Fox. I'm doing a quick announcement here for everybody, and hopefully we're online and broadcasting. We've got some really nasty weather moving into a couple of the spots we're broadcasting with, so bear with us in case we have some glitches with the programming tonight. We've got a very special broadcast lined up for you. So with that, I'm going to step out of here and hand it over to Fox. Fox.
Thank you, sir. Thank everybody for tuning in. This is the Armory on You Have Tread on Me Radio. Tonight we have Randy Mack and Gary Hunt on. A very special broadcast we got lined up for you on April the 19th. Today, 236 years ago, our forefathers stood and faced tyranny. They looked those lobster backs dead in the face, and they said no. And to me, that takes a lot more courage than signing a piece of paper and sending it over the ocean to be read several months later. And that's not to downgrade the Declaration. It's a wonderful, wonderful document, and everything it stands for is outstanding. But April 19th, to me, is held in higher regard. And I'd like to start the show off with a moment of silence for the men who died on April 19th, 236 years ago. All right, Randy. How's everything going down there tonight? You're not having any weather issues, too, are you?
Hell no. I'm actually having my first what looks like spring in about 2 years. It's going to snow again this weekend, though, so it'll be gone probably, the spring day for me will be gone tomorrow or something like that. But this is probably one of 15 days I've seen of that even somewhat resembles a spring day in 2 years. So I'm actually kind of happy about it today.
Can't complain about that. How's everything going on your end, Gary?
Just fine. An observation, though, I look at today is 236 years ago today, the revolution was over and the war for independence began.
Good point. well, tonight sounds like we're simulcasting to viewers, listeners in the UK. So special shout out to you, ladies and gentlemen in the UK. Thanks for tuning in. And we're going to be talking about tonight is a little, just a short history on what happened on the 19th in 75 that began the war for independence, the outright war. We're going to talk a bit about the committees of safety and a real big push for that this weekend, which we're going to call the Do or Die Weekend. probably going to be going for a little bit longer on Saturday on my show. I don't want to speak for Randy, but I'll be going a little bit longer. And really, we're pushing real hard to set up a bunch of committees this weekend. So definitely tune in and become active. You know, Skype calls, call-in lines, as long as that's still active, not having technical difficulties.
No, my the VoIP provider, the toll-free line provider, the guy who I'm getting the toll-free line from, he's actually in the Caribbean on vacation right now, so he's unavailable.
Ah, must be nice.
So I made a mistake. He won't be back until tomorrow, so by this weekend we'll have our line working again, though.
Okay, well, we'll keep you posted on that then. well, Randy, go ahead and talk a little bit about the committees and what we can do to get these started.
Oh, the committees are a very simple concept. Back when our revolution started, not the war itself, but the revolution that happened before the war, the people of the colonies were getting really upset with the king. He was violating the rights of Englishmen. So the militia one of the militias in Massachusetts at the time revoked their subordination to Governor Ambrose, and they turned to the people and they asked them to create a civil authority that they could subordinate to. This was always a part of Magna Carta. This was the rights of Englishmen. So the people in that area formed a committee of safety, that civil authority. The militia subordinated to them. And that local body there in that county sent the militia off to arrest Governor Andros. And eventually sent him back to England when the king sent for him. And when he got back, neither the king nor the governor ever spoke out against what they did. And that was when the American colonists started taking control of their local governmental functions. The committee started filling in the roles that the government was falling down on, wasn't fulfilling their duty in, or in which they were completely and utterly violating their rights in. For instance, in that county in Massachusetts where they took over, where the Committee of Safety formed at, the first one, eventually they took over all functions of the government. And this spread throughout the colonies. And eventually those committees of safety started forming state committees of safety. And then all the states decided to send their delegates up to the national gathering of the committees of safety, which was known as a Continental Congress then. So the committees of safety, in a layman's term, are a parallel government to fill in the gaps where our government is falling down at. And in some cases, it actually took over and became the government. That's why we didn't end up in a civil war again right after our revolution. We had a civil body already in place. We had a political body. We had a governmental body in place already during the entire war. And it stayed in place until the implementation of the Articles of Confederation, when it handed over power to the new government. And we have this was the driving force of that revolution during that time, were these committees of safety. They mustered the militia, they controlled the government bodies there, they formed courts, committee of safety courts. They held trials against people for various complaints, including people infiltrating, people that were Tory infiltrators or provocateurs, Tory spies, people that were inimical to the cause of the Englishmen at the time who were fighting for their freedom, people who were dividing and conquering them, if you will. They served many different roles, they did many different things, but primarily, though, during that time, they acted as the government of the American colonies, and they mustered and controlled the militia. They were the government.
And that's really what we lack right now. excuse me. This goes back to a Malcolm X quote that I mentioned a couple shows ago. This isn't meant as a kind of racial, I'm agreeing with Malcolm X on everything. No. This is me hearing a good quote and following it and reciting it regularly. Now, when the government fails, and the government itself has failed us, we stop turning to them and turn to ourselves. And that's what the committees of safety are. We're turning to ourselves because the government is not just failing, but they have turned against us. Now, I'd like to mention the Southern Poverty Law Center, if I'm not mistaken, is now part of the Department of Homeland Security.
Correct.
Okay. Their most latest list.
They're serving in an advisory capacity or some such nonsense.
Yeah, great idea. But their most latest list, if you look through all the 50 states that they listed, the domestic extremists, anti-government, whatever groups, every single state has the Constitution Party listed. So if by swearing to uphold, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, a form of government, how exactly does that make me anti-government? This is what I fail to understand. And it comes down to look at what they're saying and look at what they're doing, and you could see the agenda. It's quite clear. They are smearing and they are demonizing the Constitution. And they have declared war on the Constitution. So, where does that leave us? That is our duty to uphold that Constitution, preserve it, and defend it for our posterity, just like our fathers did. And they stood up against the most well-disciplined, technologically advanced, strongest army, the empire of the world, and said no. We don't have that anymore. We don't have the intestinal fortitude to stand up anymore. And it's time that we start establishing the committees. And it's time. You know, we don't have another generation to do this. We are the last. They've stolen our youth. Ask any 13, 14-year-old kid, any kid in high school, most kids in college, what does the Constitution mean? What is real personal liberties? They don't know and they don't care. I've heard it called the me generation, the screenagers, the screen generation. Or are they looking at a computer screen, a cell phone screen, or the TV screen? They don't care about the Constitution because they haven't been taught what personal freedom really is. They haven't been taught about any of these things. And that's exactly what Hitler did. He stole the youth. We have no time. We can't hand this off to anybody else. If you're alive right now, this is it. You are the last stand. Hopefully it's not a Custer's last stand. But don't mean to rant there, I apologize. Well, Randy, a couple people probably wondering about how to actually get these committees started. If I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about ways to advertise or to get people understanding of the committees, you know, what are some pointers that you have about somebody starting from nothing?
Well, you know what? I can tell you what I would do to start a committee of safety, but I would honestly ask Gary what he did to start a committee of safety. I always try to defer back to the actual hands-on experience versus theoretical experience here. So if you don't mind, I'd like to pass that question on to Gary, and let's talk about what Gary did to actually get the people of, what was it, South Central Florida, Gary?
Central Florida.
Central Florida area. Yeah. Excited about a committee of safety and how we got 300 people in a committee of safety in one day.
Actually, South Bend, Indiana as well. There were, back in the 90s, we had five committees of safety. Two of them I helped to get started. The first one, there's a flyer on committee.org that, have you given your consent? And that was the flyer. We got the local television stations to announce the meeting at the public library, the radio stations. We had 300 people show up. Unfortunately, the library closed at 9 o'clock and the meeting started at 7. But we had over 300 people there, including the press. And out of that came a committee of safety. Understanding the concept of committee of safety, though, going a little further, and it's been a learning process for me, but I've been studying it since 1993. Actually, you have two bodies. You have an association. Those are the members of the civil body politic. They need not be on the committee of safety if they're members of the association. The committee of safety is the executive for the civic body politic. And we had 13 people that sat on the committee of safety then. The other people were part of the association. And we brought that group together. Now, I left Central Florida shortly after that. And shortly after that, that was in 1990, early 95. Shortly after that, just political pressure caused people in the Patriot, because of an event in Oklahoma City, caused people to rethink their participation in the Patriot community, and the militias disbanded and everything pretty much fell apart. But the other one in South Bend, Indiana, we did pretty much the same thing. We had a radio host up there and a television host who brought Dave Leeper on to talk about committees of safety. And Dave Leeper was one of the guys that really helped me with research. He went to the Notre Dame Law Library and went through looking for everything he could find on committee of safety at the time, and we found numerous original documents that we could get microfilm copies of. And so we started compiling some of these documents together, and you'll see Committees of Safety, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Volume 1 I wrote, Volume 2 was mostly Dave's work, and it was piecing together how they functioned, and we've learned a lot since then. More information is becoming available. But they started a committee of safety up there, and they had 30-some people. Now, South Bend isn't as big as Orlando, and the Patriot community was relatively small, but we did have participation from local radio station and television station who did interviews, short ones, 5 or 10 minute interviews with Dave to get the word out. And we handed out flyers as well, posted them at grocery stores and everything. But first you've got to come up with a place to meet, and then you've got to make a little flyer that'll interest people. And then from there you go to have your meeting. And today, the mood is a little different than it was back in the 90s. Because of Waco, back in the 90s, the mood was more directed at the militia movement. After Waco, the militia movement developed and continued on into 95, 96, then began disbanding. A new element has entered the Patriot community nowadays, and that is the Tea Party place, people who by now should be realizing the futility of their efforts and looking for a place to go out of the Tea Party. And so the direction is and then we've got Katrina, which is another situation that came up recently. So the direction that we're looking at now is along the lines that the committees of safety can help when there's natural or man-made disasters, they can paint houses for little old ladies, mow lawns for little old men that can't push the lawnmower. They can secure the area and save the police the necessity of doing it in a situation like Katrina. But understanding the committees of safety, Randy explained quite a bit of it, but there are so many aspects. But what is most significant, and this came up in a conversation with a fellow the other day, there's an organization out there that's trying to build a government on top of our government or under our government or something like that. I'm not sure how to describe it. But they're trying to coexist two governments in the same place at the same time. And that's awful confusing. In fact, it's awful confusing when you look at the Constitution, and the Constitution says the states have a Republican form of government, then you've got the federal government overriding them. So, good example, medical marijuana laws in a number of states, the federal government comes in and takes doctors' licenses away and things like that. That's what happens when you have two governments overlapping each other. The committees of safety, though, fill in where there's a void in the government activity. And let's go back to Katrina. The police were overworked during Katrina. So if a 10-block square area had a committee of safety and they formed together, called a militia or something to protect themselves, they would save the police that work. They would fill in where adequate support could not be provided by the existing government. By the same token, if there was a shortage of food, people within the association could share food amongst themselves, water, fresh water or potable water, safe water to drink. Any number of things can happen that the government cannot provide for, but the people themselves can provide for. And this is exactly what happened back in the 1760s, 1770s, even French and Indian War, that a lot of communities, the provincial government could not, the crown government could not provide safety to people who were taking land out on the frontier, Susquehanna Valley, western Pennsylvania, western New York, and there were problems with Indians. So they would form committees of safety, they would muster the militia, they would have night watchmen. They weren't trying to supplant the British government, they were trying to provide what the British government could not provide. And I think we all know by now that the Supreme Court has ruled that the policeman has no obligation to protect us. Well, that leaves us protecting ourselves. So if a severe situation came up and we had a committee of safety, that committee of safety then could deal with that situation by mustering their forces in whatever manner necessary. So they would be filling in alongside the other government. They would not be trying to push them out unless things changed to a point that it became necessary to push them out, which, again, we go back to 1774 in western Massachusetts, where the Parliament had revoked the Massachusetts Charter. They invoked the Boston Port Act, and just a week or two later, they invoked the Massachusetts Government Act. The Massachusetts Government Act revoked the charter, actually both charters that existed for Massachusetts, and revoking the charter is like revoking the Constitution. So the people in western Massachusetts were outraged at this. And so they, the committees of safety sent the militia out to force the judges who were assigned their jobs by Parliament under the Government Act to resign and to not allow the courts to open. So when government gets bad enough, the Committee of Safety then, even though it's filling in alongside, gets to a point that they start pushing out the existing government because the existing government has walked away from its obligation to the people. They started setting, Worcester, Massachusetts, for example, in September 1774, well before Lexington and Concord, declared independence from the British government and British authority. They let go the militia, let everybody go, and then they reopened the militia, not allowing Tories to enter into the militia. They got all the Tories out of the picture. They then opened courts so they could deal with criminal matters and deal with Tories who were a threat to the security of Worcester, Massachusetts. So they coexisted for a while, but then they started pushing out the unlawful government, the government that was imposing itself in violation of the Constitution or the Charter. So the Committee of Safety sits alongside the other government until the situation warrants displacing the other government. But to start a Committee of Safety, how many people does it take? And I've found references as small as three people in a local Committee of Safety. By the time you get to the county, it wants to be larger. Now the county will be, Committee of Safety will be peopled by people that have come up from the local committees of safety. So people have shaken hands and they know these people. It's not some guy that's dangled on a piece of string in front of you that you've never heard of until CNN picked him up and he's running for governor of the state. These are people that go from the town or city level to the county level and then to the state level, and they've established a reputation on the way up that ladder. So if you have three people in a town, or say five, six, seven people to be the Committee of Safety, you also need to look at what is your association, the people that subscribe to the Committee of Safety. And they become the civil body politic that the Committee of Safety is the executive for. And that's the structure of it. So once you have a Committee of Safety, say the leadership, then you need to expand yourself. Bring your neighbors in. Explain to them that if there's ever tornadoes, we'll be there to pull the tree off of your car or whatever else you need. If you need food, if you need water, we'll be there to help you. We need to act in a, I hate to use this term because communism has grabbed it, but we need to work in a collective manner to look out for ourselves, for our own safety, our security, our health, and everything else. And so you can expand the committee under the concept of association. Anybody that signs on is a member, whether they're on the Committee of Safety or not, and they will participate in looking out for their neighbors, which is how this country began. So I think I went a little further with Randy on Committees of Safety, and to the best of my ability, I've explained how we started a Committee of Safety back then. I'm not in a position now to start one. I'm planning on leaving where I am. When I get to where I'm going, wherever that might be, I will again try and start a Committee of Safety. I will again start a Committee of Safety, but until I know where I'm going, I can't do it.
Well, it's a timeless thing. It's something that we've had since before, before we colonized here. It was... before Magna Carta was when the civil subordination began. So for those of you in the UK, this isn't just for the United States. You guys ought to do this too. Things along the lines of committees of safety. They're also known as associations. They went by different names, but they all had the same objective. And that was to fill in where the government decided, excuse me, where the government decided it wasn't going to. Now, what kind of things, Gary, if you don't mind answering another question about the committees, what kind of things need to be said, and what should an appropriate outline for a first meeting be?
Well, I think the concept, needs to be presented as one, as I mentioned, talking about Katrina, talking about painting a little old lady's fence whose husband died and she can't take care of her own house, mowing her lawn, things like that. Just a cooperative community effort, I think, at this point is what needs to be presented to people to realize. And you know, with the tornadoes in the southeast yesterday or today, whenever it was, and the devastation, it's an ideal situation to pick people up. But to not forget the function, there are a lot of militias right now, for example, who are beginning to look for a civil body to subordinate to should their government or the governor not want them. you just have to feel in your community what's appropriate. You don't have Indians attacking you. Some Indians the other day were concerned that I mentioned Indians, but I'm speaking historically. You don't have Indians attacking you now, but look at what potential for disaster might occur and where you can help yourself rather than sit on your hands and wait for FEMA to do something. FEMA bought, what, 10,000, 80,000, a whole bunch of trailers for Katrina. Then they decided, which everybody who's ever had a trailer knows, that there's formaldehyde in those trailers, so they never use them. I don't know what they did with them. That's how competent the government is in dealing with an emergency. People were sleeping outside because these trailers had formaldehyde in them. So we need to look at, you know, what we how we can serve our community. I think that's the main point in addressing Committee of Safety at this point. Now, there are others that will be more concerned about the militia, and the militia has to subordinate to a civil authority, if not their warlords, and their wandering tribes going out and doing whatever they want to do. Did I get your question on that, Fox?
Yeah, I mean...
You know, let's talk about that for a moment, if you wouldn't mind. I'd like to kind of analyze that last statement you made there, Gary, when you talked about militia that don't have a that don't subordinate to a civil authority. You know, let's look at another revolution that happened right around the time that ours did, just a little bit afterwards. And let's look at their revolution, and let's look at their militia and how they organized themselves versus how we did. That was the French Revolution. I know many of you know how that ended. It was bloody as hell. You wouldn't mind going into that a little bit, Gary. Let's touch upon that.
Well, they weren't militia, they were gangs, and they followed the their favorite leader. And the leaders were the people that started the French Revolution, were all friends at one point, and they started the revolution. And after a while, they were cutting each other's heads off, and gangs were going down the street following one leader or the other. So each person who was a leader, self-proclaimed, not selected through a committee of safety process like we've talked about, is a warlord, and he wants power. And if he can get to a position where he could lop the other guy's head off, he's going to have his blood running down the street. It was very vicious, and nothing came of it. It was just turmoil. It eventually led to Napoleon and all kinds of subsequent problems, and it wasn't until World War II, after World War II, that France got the first semi-stable government since its bloody revolution. Of 1785? Somewhere around then.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe it was 1785, 1780. It's plus or minus a couple of years.
So that's the warlord attitude. And let's look at a situation, say, Mexicans attacked one of the southern states, and so you've got a number of militias along the border states, and they decide that they're going to go fight the Mexicans that are invading across the border. And so they just say, hey, I hear there's some Mexicans down here, let's go down here. What's the possibility of them getting in a firefight with a bunch of Mexican heritage militia members from another county near them, because they don't know these guys, because there's nothing coordinated between them, and they're so busy pulling out their guns wanting to shoot somebody that they end up having a firefight with their own side. Now, when there are militias, there are assignments. The militia was directed by the Committee of Safety, whether it be town or county or even provincial level, on where to go and who to report to. They determined who was in charge. When you've got people coming, well, good example, the siege of Boston. Since it was in Massachusetts, Israel Putnam was put in charge. But you had militias coming from Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, and New Hampshire. And I don't know if there were others involved in that or not, but at least those. But they were all told to report to Massachusetts, and when they got to Massachusetts, they were informed that they were under the command of Israel Putnam. So there was coordinated effort, and they didn't go shooting each other. They all had a task. There was coordination of the whole effort. What we see in the Patriot community now, and I'm not going to mention the state of Georgia, but people are vying for command of the militia in an unnamed state. he who yells the loudest apparently is going to be the commander, and none of them have any practical experience in leadership in the field. None of them have an idea of demonstrating their ability to command a larger force. In fact, most of them are high-ranking officers that command maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 people. Now, in a realistic sense, if you're commanding 20 people, you're a lieutenant at best. So the entire structure now is a yelling contest. It's who you can get to come to your web page. And there's no coordination. There's no effort at coordination. There are efforts at coordination of certain activities. In fact, there's a group called CECOM right now that's trying to coordinate standardization so that there is at least a means of communicating without this, I don't want to call it backstabbing, so I won't call it anything. But they're trying to establish a common ground for people to work with. But the committees of safety, that civil authority, is the one that will decide if the area of operation is in this area. They're going to assign somebody from that area if there's anybody competent in that area to be in charge of the whole. If that person is appointed and then proves incompetent, he would be removed and somebody else would come in. And they don't have to appoint somebody necessarily from their area if somebody from somewhere else comes qualified. But by working through the civil authority and being directed, now if you read it's online at committee.org, provincial committees of safety, for example, in most of the provinces, and this is based on research done by a lady named Agnes Hunt, and it's hard to find records, but in most of the ones where she could identify the committees of safety role in dealing with the militia, the provincial committee of safety's job was to direct the actions of the militia, not to tell them fire now, set up a line here, not military matters, but direct the actions of the militia by sending them to an area and who was going to be in command so that they could coordinate and work as an effective larger unit, something that we don't have now, and something that would exist if we had the civil body politic, because the people in the militia have to obey the commands of the city body, civil body politic, which is the committees of safety. So you can see how the structure changes drastically when you've got people whose job is to communicate with others and decide the best approach in dealing with the problem, as opposed to the gung-ho guys to want to go out and start shooting their rifles at anything.
You know, and that is a major problem that we have today. We really have no coordination anymore. We have no standardization of standards, of practices of any sort whatsoever. We have good militia groups out there that are trying to work towards that are working on a standardization within their group and within, you know, other groups around them and within their state. We haven't gotten there yet, though. This is a problem we have. We also have no civil subordination. So, you know, worst case scenario, if something did happen in our country today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, and the militia were needed, we would be in a world of hurt.
Well, it would turn into Somalia, and I mentioned this last week. Without civil subordination, something bad happening would be a catalyst to chaos. And each block, different communities and cities would be run by different, for lack of a better word, warlords. And then it turns into a situation in which power makes rights, which this is exactly what would happen.
And that's exactly what happened in the French Revolution. The warlords followed their chosen leader with no coordination. Yeah. That's where we are now.
That's exactly what's happening in Somalia right now and other countries that are ravaged and ignored. Whoever has the strongest group of guys and the most guns becomes dictator of their block or of their city or whatever.
You know, to stress that point, let's look back to another republic that used to exist a long time ago, Rome. During the period of around, what was it, 40 to 65 A.D., during the time when Caesar was just rising up in the ranks, you know, he would have, I think his actual position was something like, parks and recreation, you know, minister or something like that. That was his role. He handled the parks there in Rome. Wasn't quite Caesar yet. There was a whole group of people that were up and about at the time. One of them was a young man named Pompey the Great, Pompey Magnus. He was way too young to be a commander of armies, but because of a civil war that had just happened, he was able to get power quickly. And for the first time in Roman history, he stood outside of the gates with an army. And when someone from the Roman Senate went to talk to him and started quoting Roman law, his response was, "Do not quote law to men with swords." And right after that, the Roman Empire fell, or the Roman Republic fell, and it became the Roman Empire. And Caesar became Caesar. And the Senate was, for all intents and purposes, gone and dead.
What if we start telling the government, do not quote law when you face people with rifles?
They said that to us. They ignored
the Constitution,
and they are very open. There was a Chicago politician who said, "I don't really care about the Constitution." And they go, "Oh, gotcha." And he goes, "What? I don't care. What are you going to do?"
Now, let's turn that around, though. Suppose we said, don't quote law to me. I've got a gun. And said it with sincerity.
Forgive me, I'm not quite...
Well, we've allowed the government to say to us, don't quote law, we've got a gun. Now, if we acted as a civil body politic and told the government, don't quote law to me, we have a gun too. Does that make it clear?
Well, we are quoting law. We are the ones trying to uphold the law. They are the ones who are outside
no.
the law.
Well, what no, the Constitution, not the law. The law says, thou shalt not go over 35 in this speed zone.
Okay.
The Constitution says we have the right to keep and bear arms. That means carry them with the intention of using them. So if we turn that around, if we become an effective force and turn it around and tell the government, do not quote law to me, we have guns. That's exactly what the Founding Fathers meant when they put the Second Amendment in the Constitution, isn't it?
Once we become an effective force.
Right.
Once we have that, that's the key point to your last statement, was once we become effective, once we have our civil subordination, militias or whatever you want to call them,
yeah.
with our committees of safety, then we will see difference.
Right.
So yes,
you know, that's a good point, though. You know, in 1968, when the Gun Control Act came out, which was nothing more than a translated version, word-for-word translation, of Hitler's Gun Control Act. Now, in 1968, what would have happened when they tried to pass that bill and every gun-owning American, remember, back then, we had machine guns. What if every gun-owning American had stepped out and said, come get them? The Gun Control Act of 1968 would be a footnote in history.
I'll tell you where the Gun Control Act's come to. California's a perfect state to understand it. It was back in the 90s that they required registration of all assault weapons. And they defined that as anything with multiple magazines that... especially if it has a bayonet mount. So all these people registered their assault weapons. A couple of years later, they came out and said, turn in your assault weapons. They are now illegal in California. So all these people had put their neck on the block by abiding by that law, by complying with that law. It was effective here. I read an interesting article quite a while ago by a retired police officer who had an assault rifle. He registered it, and he was outraged at the tactic the government used, and he was sure that their intention all along was to get a list of where they could send letters to say, turn it in or you're in trouble. So gun laws are there. Any registration of firearms is there to trick you into telling the government where they need to go if they want to collect the guns. They don't have to collect them now. They'll collect them when they feel that they have a need to. If they want to get you out of the picture somehow, they will go collect your guns. And, you know, most people talk about their last stand. When they come to get my guns, I'm going to give it to them one bullet at a time. That will be the last stand that for that person. He will either be dead or in prison. But he's put his name, voluntarily put his name on the list. I won't say if I've got any guns. I will say that I have never registered a gun. Now, I see all these people, you know, on various militia sites bragging about the firearms they've got. One thing they've not got is the standardization of ammunition. So when you run out of your odd caliber ammunition, you might be SOL or have to find something else. But they're always talking about what type of firearm they have, or listing all 7 that they've got, or all 37. And they don't realize that there's probably people getting paid by the government to sit down and take notes. Now, you might be lying, just bolstering your ego by saying, I've got all these guns. But hey, whether you registered them or not, they've got your name, and they can, no matter what your name is on the internet, they can find out who you are. And they've got a list, an inventory of what they would want from you should they come knocking on your door. And you can give it to them one bullet at a time. Or if you want to save your life, you can hand them all over very peaceably. But to brag about what firearms you've got on the internet is probably second only to obedience to the gun registration laws.
Well, there are, you know, there's a state known as Illinois, which has no carry law. You know, you cannot carry openly or concealed if you are not a badge. You know, if you're a cop, you can do whatever you want. But for us civilians or citizens, we have no carry law. We are the last state without carry law. We also have the highest crime rate. But we also have the FOID system, the Firearms Owner's Identification Card. That is by the federal, you know, the national constitution, unlawful. But by the state of Illinois' constitution, lawful. The state of Illinois' Second Amendment, basically, I believe it's Article 4, I'm not sure, says, subject only to the powers of the police, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This sentence is a contradiction upon itself. It can be infringed by the police, but it shall not be infringed.
Have you gone back and looked at the history of the ratification of that amendment to see if it was slid in one way, some way to get you?
It was placed in the Illinois Constitution during a convention, I believe in the 78. In the 70s, there was a constitutional convention and it was slipped in there. And now, as anybody could have predicted, the Attorney General of this state is trying to make a law in which every FOID holder is required to basically list him or herself as a sex offender for a website, for a page on the state's website listing where all of the FOID cards are.
Well, you know, one of the dilemmas that I, and you know, this gets personal to me because I had two friends executed by the government, murdered by the government in Alabama over something similar. But what always bothers me is the supreme law of the land says that I have the right to keep and bear arms. And the supreme law the states owe an obedience to, especially the Bill of Rights. And I know it didn't used to be that way back in the early 1800s, but by the time of the Civil War, it was imposed on all the states by virtue of the 14th Amendment. Now, I know absolutely I've got the right to keep and bear arms. Now, I spent 2 years traveling around the country talking about Waco and investigating things, and I never went unarmed. What has always bothered me is if I get stopped and I have a gun and the cop says, you can't have that gun, I know I have the right to have that gun, and he thinks that I don't. Now, that creates a serious dilemma. Are you going to defend your right with his life or not? So, you know, it's up to us whether we are willing to defend those rights or not.
The only rights they can take away are those that we give.
Absolutely. The ones that we are willing to give up. We don't give them, we give them up. We walk away from defending that right. I mean, it's not like we walk up and hand it across the counter, but when we're confronted with it, we back down. We don't stand behind our rights.
That's something that has led us into the horrific time crunch that we are experiencing now. Once again, they've stolen our youth. If not us, then who?
There is no time left. There is no time left. You know, we needed to start this 20 years ago when they started declaring their war on drugs, their war on this, their war on that, and they used all of these little social wars to completely and utterly militarize the police. We went from search warrants to battering rams. And we did nothing. We did not one damn thing. We watched in the 90s as they executed a whole bunch of people who were doing nothing wrong over a supposed under $100 tax.
Well,
and we did nothing. You know, we watched Ruby Ridge happen, we did nothing. So, I don't know. We need to start figuring out when we're going to start doing something. Because the more we do nothing, the worse it gets. Look back over the last 25 years. How bad has it gotten?
Well, let me quote.
Now the feds are allowed to stand on your doorstep and write out their own search warrant.
Let me quote from the Declaration of Independence, one of the items enumerated there. He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislature. Now, it has consent of the legislature, which kind of ticks me off because the state legislatures have all acquiesced to federal authority in exchange for federal dollars. But there's a big misunderstanding, and it comes from government schools, as to what a standing army is. If you read the founders, the standing army was the guys with guns in Boston. That's why that was written. Boston, Massachusetts did not authorize the redcoats, the lobster backs, to come into Boston, but they were there among the people. It wasn't a standing army like having a cavalry on the frontier to chase down Indians or protect settlers. It was having people with rifles living amongst us to enforce the will of the king. Now, we have 1 million, approximately, standing army in this country today. Every town, every city, every county, and every state has standing armies. We refer to them as police departments. But they are the standing army, the people with guns in the streets that will use those guns to force you to comply with their dictates. That is the standing army the founders were concerned with. It had nothing to do with soldiers, unless they were amongst us. Now, what's the difference between a soldier in a U.S. Army uniform and a soldier, probably better equipped, in a policeman's uniform? There is no difference. That standing army, 1 million strong, exists amongst us today. And we fought a war over it.
Well, Randy, I'd mentioned in his show a few weeks ago, if there's one thing we learn from history, it's that people do not learn from history. Well, all due respect, Randy, I'm not trying to, you know, trying to be rude here, but people do learn from history, but not government people. Governments learn from history.
This is true.
Exactly how they got around that standing army.
This is true.
I was about to bring that up, Gary. That's a great point that nobody thinks about. You can't get away. Like you said, every local town, municipality, township, county, state, they all have police. And they are armed to the teeth. Small towns with APCs? You kidding me? Full-sized M16s with bayonet lugs and all these things that the federal government is just granting to small town police departments. Small towns of 600-800 people do not need an APC with just as much armor as an MRAP rolling down the street of Baghdad. Say what you want. The police have become a tool.
Now let's look at where the federal government came in to expand that standing army too. In 1994, there was something called the Crime Control Act of 1994. Those that remember back then would recognize it more by cops on the street. That's what they called the program, where they were going to put cops on the street. Now, I did a article on that quite some time ago. It's on my webpage. But basically what they said is, for those little towns and little cities and even counties that don't have enough cops on the street, we will fund you to add additional law enforcement officers, nice name for army, to your force, and we will pay their full salary first year, 75% of the salary second year, 30% of the third year, 50% of their salary. Fourth year, 25%, fifth year, you're on your own. However, don't worry, because while we're doing this, we will teach you how to use asset forfeiture to offset the cost of these additional officers. And also, they put a little string in there that made the police departments subordinate to the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice. The string still exists. They are obliged. They are, in a sense, deputized by the Department of Justice under that Crime Control Act of 1994. They have pledged obedience to the Department of Justice of the United States. Now, how can you shake these cops loose from federal authority, good, bad, or indifferent? And let's go to Waco. The McLennan County Sheriff's Department was part of the security team around the perimeter, and it was the largest crime scene perimeter in this country, to the best of my knowledge. The Texas State Police, or State Troopers, and the Texas Rangers were also deputized as part of that protective force. The Waco Police Department was in charge of the, since it was outside the city limits, was in charge of the press conferences. So they had deputized all these people during the course of the events in Waco. And these people, I met with Maurice Cook, who was commander of the Texas Rangers at the time, and he explained that there's nothing that they can do. They have been deputized. They had no choice but to abide by federal law based upon the contracts they had with the Department of Justice. Now, this was before the Crime Control Act of 1994, but those tentacles that I found in the Crime Control Act of 1994, to some degree, were already in extent. Just like the school system, if they accepted federal money, there were strings that came with that money. So all these local law enforcement people had to abide by the dictates of Department of Justice. And there's a question in the Constitution whether the Department of Justice has any authority at all out in the farmlands of Waco, Texas. The point that we brought up constantly when I was down there. But that just gets walked around. Nobody cares about whether they have federal authority. They assume the federal authority. They deputize the local people. The local people blindly accept the authority. And there you have it. So we have the standing army.
Well, we go down the list of all the things that were, all of the offenses that were submitted to a candid world in the Declaration, and find similarities to every single one. Some more than others. But the President, Secretary of State, all these other people who are very open about their hate for the Constitution and their disgust with personal freedom, are very open about going to the international courts, going to international treaties like CIFTA. That was a few years ago, and I was up in arms about it. I was pissed. And everybody called me nuts. Until Fox News and CNN, MSNBC, all of them started coming out and saying, oh, well, looks like Obama and Hillary Clinton are going to go to international treaty to ban firearms. No, they're not going to ban the firearms. They're not going to implement martial law. They're not going to throw troops on the streets overnight. No. They're going to bleed us out the exact same way that they've been doing it for, arguably, since the war between the states. You're not going to get a chance to look outside and say, this is it. There's troops on my streets. It's time. You're not going to get that chance. There's not going to be another Waco. Not at once. Not another Ruby Ridge. There's going to be 100 little Wacos. And 100 little Ruby Ridges. And like I said, they're going to bleed us out. They are slowly going to sap our will. More so than they already have. And slowly, piece by piece, slowly burn and destroy everything that we hold dear. The Declaration of Independence is a legal document. Any right mentioned and given to us in that legal document is guaranteed. The right to alter or to abolish and institute new government, that's our right now. We need to stand up and we need to do it, because they are not going to do it overnight. They're not going to take everything away. I am absolutely amazed that nothing happened after the Gun Control Act of, what was that, Randy, 64 or 68?
68.
I want to look at these people. These people who say that they represent us. Any time that they come along with one of these wonderful bills, I want to look them in the face and ask them, who the hell do you think you are?
Well, let's talk about what will happen. I mean, you said there's not going to be another Waco, and I agree there's not. There were small Wacos already. Donald Scott and Gordon Call were examples of small Wacos where just one or two people were involved. But if we think about how the government can approach this, they know who the leadership in the patriot community is, the people that patriots listen to, the ones that talk like we are tonight about doing something about the problem we face in this country. They've identified those people. As long as the government has the initiative, one day, at 8 o'clock in the Pacific, 9 o'clock Central, or Mountain, 10 o'clock Central and 11 o'clock Eastern, just like a drug raid, a national drug raid. They're going to go in and collect these people, the leadership. Now, some of her, you have heard me talk before. Now, to support that, there's a link to C3CM, which will explain a list that the government has now. I wrote an article called Informants Amongst Us that addresses how they have infiltrated our movement. Randy ran across some figures that 1 in 6 of the people in the Patriot community is a government agent. Now, if we couple
that's
that...
The agents. That's the agents. The agents.
If we couple that with the informants, where in Richard Butler's Aryan Nation Church in Idaho, the people up there told me over half the people were informants that were in the church. Now, how do you become an informant? You get charged with a crime, you sign a plea agreement, you belong to the government. So let's say somewhere between 10 and 60% of the Patriot community realistically could have different interests than you and I. So they come in and take out the leadership of the Patriot community. They know who's on their side. So they take out the ones that aren't on their side, and that leaves the ones that are on their side who have worked their way up, wormed their way up into roles of near leadership. So when the void is created in the leadership, their own people are going to come in and fill in those voids wherever they can. When they do that, then, excuse me, those that follow them are going to be misdirected. They're going to be going where the guy sends them, which is not where they need to go because this guy's working for the government. The only way that that can be avoided, that circumstance can be avoided, is if you have thinking heads in the committees of safety, preferably including a number of Vietnam vets, the older vets who are too old to go humping out in the field, but have reasoned heads and understand tactics that can direct these forces in the proper direction rather than these guys following somebody they met on the internet. The only thing they've ever seen with the picture is a picture of him holding a rifle, and they don't even know if it's him. That's the only way that that can be forestalled, unless what I just described leaves the initiative in the hands of the government. They will set the date, they will set the time, and they will come in and under any pretext arrest anybody that they can. And you know, they might apologize a week later, but a week later it's too late. Oh, shoot, we thought you had drugs in the house, and we looked all over, and we couldn't find them. Sorry we didn't let you out on bail for all that time, but we thought we'd find the drugs, and we just didn't find them. So you're back on the street, but all of a sudden the world has changed that you just left. So their leadership has moved in. They've got the initiative. They have set the playing field, and they have inserted their players wherever possible in the leadership. So if you got, say, half the Patriot groups are still Patriots and the other half are government informants or people with the government's interest at heart, where are you? You've got chaos. You've got nothing. You've got no means of coordination if you don't know who those people are, which is why we're setting this court system up, by the way. However, that aside, the option, the alternative to that is, what if we take the initiative? Now, there's something that we call the plan. It's the plan for restoration of constitutional government. That is a way that if we can get organized quickly enough, even in small pockets, even if only a couple small towns around the country get organized, we can begin to take the initiative away from the government. And if we take the initiative away from the government, we have undermined all that planning of theirs. We will out the bad guys, and we will control the playing field. There's an old saying in the military, the best defense is a good offense. I'm doing a lot of reading about history, and quite often, a fort, 96 in the South, can't think of all the forts now, but often when they knew there was an attacking force, if that attacking force on the fort was given the time and set up a perimeter, they could seize the fort. So the best defense was to send soldiers out to attack the attacking force before they could get set up. The best defense is a good offense. And in military terms, very often that is absolutely true, that if you take the offense, you have done more for yourself than you have by saying, when they come to get my guns, I'm going to shoot them.
If you say they come to take my guns, I'm getting on the radio with my committee of safety, and you will be outnumbered and outgunned, that would make a difference. Much bigger difference than these little catchy come and take them, I'll give you my guns one bullet at a time.
Yeah, that only worked once in Texas.
You know what's funny, though, about these little slogans and all these chants that we have and this rhetoric that we have? There was a very famous man, and he said, we will control the people with slogans and chants. And that's pretty much what we have today. That man was named Stalin. And that's what socialism did. It brought out the slogans and the chants for us to all rally behind. And unfortunately, with these slogans and these chants comes the understanding of what they really mean. And the mental fortitude to see those chants and those slogans through. And Gary has pointed this out many times. I've pointed this out many times. We hear all these people saying, they can have my guns one bullet at a time. But when the cops come for them, they give them up really quick. You know, there's been many people, when the cops came for them, they tucked tail and ran. Or they gave up.
Or they ended up dead.
Or they ended up dead. Because nobody else was willing to stand with them. You know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his book, The Gulag Archipelago, he was arrested. He was a high-ranking Russian officer, pretty decently ranked Russian officer. He thought he was safe from the machine. He ended up in a gulag, and afterwards he wrote a book. And in that book, he told all about it, and he talked about Leningrad, for instance. And there was a footnote in his book, and it was one of his thoughts that he had at the time, and he said, what if? What if we had done something when they came for us in the night? What if we had laid an ambush for them waiting with axes and hammers and pokers and ambushed them when they came for us? And we would know that every skull that we cracked was going to be that of an evil man. But they did nothing. And in Leningrad alone, 250,000 people, 1 in 4, were picked up, many of them never seen again. The numbers vary, but just in the Ukraine alone, 20-plus million people starved out, starved to death, because they were unneeded. They were worthless eaters. They were not politically correct. Eventually, those numbers rose upwards of, some people say, over 100 million dead by their government. Look at the numbers globally. Look at the countries that have taken away the rights of the people to own guns and see what those people, and see what happened to the people there. World War I didn't kill anybody compared to what's been happening just with these government takeovers. And just with the banning of weapons. And even in these benevolent countries, these good socialist countries, like Australia, home invasions up 500% just in 1 year. They banned all their guns. Violent crime up 300%. Stabbings abound. And the people are unarmed. They got butter knives.
Here's the biggest thing I don't understand about people who actually do support gun confiscation and the people who you see, oh yeah, I think everybody should be without guns. In England, after the ban of firearms was in full effect. They had all the guns that were registered. Armed robbery went up 300% in 6 months. But the government took all the guns. From the people who needed them most. See, you know what, criminals don't care. I'm preaching to the choir on this one.
You know what? Let's look at the reverse of that now, though. Let us look at the reverse of that here in the U.S. In fact, let's look at the exact opposite of that. There's a county in Georgia. They made a law: you will own a damn gun. Everybody will own a damn gun, and they enforced the law. And everybody had to go out and buy a gun. Guess what happened to crime? It's non-existent. Everybody's armed. What criminal is going to break into a house when they know that that home is occupied by somebody that owns guns? Every home you go into is required to have a gun. Kind of like what we used to be. Crime is down. It's almost non-existent. The criminals are killing each other off, and that's pretty much the only crime they have.
Years ago, when I got out of jail, a long time ago, I'm not going to go into the details on it, I had dinner at my attorney's house, and he had a salesman for burglar alarm systems coming, and the guy pointed out statistics. He pointed out that most criminals... have been in jail once, and they will commit crimes again. And he said that they have learned over time to not go where there is risk. So if you have a burglar alarm system installed in your house, and they know that, then you have increased the risk, which means they're going to go next door, not to your house. Now, let's go a little later. Just a few years later, I noticed people were saying, selling signs that and stickers that said you had burglar alarm systems in your house, even though you didn't have them. It's a lot easier to put a sticker up for a couple dollars than pay $600, $800, a few thousand dollars, and then monthly fees to put the burglar alarm system in. Now, those simple signs were as discouraging. The burglar didn't know if you had the burglar alarm or just a sign up. So he assumed the risk was there if you had the sign up. Now, what Randy was just talking about. If everybody's supposed to have a gun, whether they do or not, people have gotten very respectful of those people because they think they might have a burglar alarm or a gun. So it is a discouragement to criminals to do anything that will create risk for them. In fact, some friends of mine were down in Miami once from Florida, and they were driving through one part of town that wasn't very savory. And a guy came up to the window with a knife and told Linda, get out of the car, I want your car. And Linda picked up her pistol and said, get out of my face or you won't have one. The guy left. It was that simple. He saw that gun. He decided he didn't like her car anymore. All you have to do is create that little bit of fear in the bad guy, and he's going to go find an easier picking. So when you pass a law that says everybody has to have a gun, it doesn't matter if they do or not. If they think everybody's got a gun, crime will go down. Look at the cities with major crime problems. What are they? Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. And this is places where you can't openly have a gun unless you're permitted, especially by the government, to do so. So that means very few people.
Well, Chicago, absolutely not, unless you're a badge, like I said. We just recently got rid of the outright ban in the city limits, which I'm not 100% sure on who made the arguments for a gun ban being constitutional and why it was ever adopted into law, but we can get into that another time. What I do want to touch on right now...
No more people are victims. You can victimize an unarmed people. Stalin said, one man with a gun can control 100 that don't have guns. That's what all the gun banning is about.
Right. Gun control isn't about guns, it's about control. Now, I have a stopwatch here, and this is my one problem with burglar alarms. And I'm not trying to be rude, Gary, but this is just my personal opinion. 911, what is your emergency? Somebody's breaking into my house, and okay, do you have somewhere where you can stay and lock the door behind you? Yeah, I'm in the bathroom. Okay, and what's your address? 123 Fake Street. Okay, one second, I'll get you on with Fake PD. Fake PD, what's your emergency? We have possible break-in at 123 Fake Street. Okay, I will alert everybody, I will alert every officer in the area. That right there took 46 seconds. Where do you think that guy is in your house at 46 seconds?
Well, I agree with you. However, if you have the signs up and the guy next door doesn't, he's going to go to the house next door. It's discouragement. And yes, I mean, there's that one poster on the internet that I think is fascinating. Your daughter is out and somebody wants to rape her, and the cop is 7 minutes away and she's got a gun, or something like that. That's it, if you've got a way of defending yourself. But still, the sign itself is a discouragement, because they're going to go for the least risk. Even if you have the automatic system, which is quicker response, because they'll respond to that, Brink system before they'll respond to your phone call. So, no, you're not going to stop crime. You're going to discourage it only by the sign, by having the system or the signs up. It's not going to stop it, but you've diverted them away from you, made you a less likely target. But I agree with you. Relying on 911 is the stupidest thing in the world. I mean, I've seen people take their friends injured in an accident, put them in their car, and take them to the hospital because they knew what response time was, and these people were bleeding severely. They would have probably died of blood loss if they had waited for 911 to respond and get the ambulance out to the scene of an accident. So I agree with you completely.
Has become at this point, police department, hospital, ambulance services, it's just become a middleman. Somebody is coming into my house and I think they have a gun. What am I going to do? I'm going to call somebody with a gun. Buy a fucking gun. Excuse me, I don't mean to swear on my show.
I think the underlying objective, though, is what the government is trying to teach us is that they will take care of everything. They want us to stand down and say, okay, you take care of it, and if I die because of that, it's my fault, it's not your fault, because you're the government. They want us to step down and see them as the king can do no wrong, see them as superior to us. Everything they do, for the most part, is a reflection on their ability to do something and us not. For example, if there's an earthquake in this country, they put up crime scene tape, and you can't go in and save somebody's life under threat of going to prison. But if you looked at the hurricane in Japan, or I mean the tsunami in Japan, or earthquakes in China, or earthquakes in Europe or the Middle East, everybody goes in and starts moving rocks out and pulling people out and taking them to the hospital. Only in this country, where we're free, do we go to jail for trying to help somebody save their life. Because we have been taught obedience to government. Sorry for yelling.
Well, let me tell you what I did. I had a daughter. My daughter was born one day. After my daughter was born, I was holding her in my arms. And I started thinking back to all the crap that I had seen in my life living in South Central and other really shitty places. And after holding her for about 30 minutes and looking at her and thinking about all this, I looked to my wife. I said, I'll be back in a couple of hours. She started protesting a little bit. I ignored her. I walked out that door. I went down the road to Charlie's Guns and Ammo, down on Central in Albuquerque. I walked in. I said, hey, Charlie, how you doing? I pointed to a subcompact Springfield Arms V12 compensated 45. Mm-hmm. I said, my daughter was born today. That's her birthday present. Can you wrap it for me? They wouldn't let me take the gun to the hospital, so instead I took a magazine in there and I gave it to my daughter and I said, happy birthday, sweetie. Even though she couldn't hold it yet. Because I'll be damned if I was going to have her waiting around possibly one day for a police to get there after she dials 911. I'll be damned if she's going to be the victim of a rape because she didn't have any way to defend herself. I'll be damned if she was going to call 911 and hear elevator music after the operator said, please hold. And I'll be damned if she was going to have to wait 20 minutes for the average police response time for a 911 call. It's better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6.
I'm pretty sure mine are going to come out holding guns, Randy.
You know, that's the problem we have today, though. We are afraid. And we are, and we have become domesticated almost.
No, you hit that right on the, you hit the bullet right on the primer. We have become domesticated.
We expect government to come save us. And you know, and the sad thing is we keep hearing everybody every day when something upsets them or something happens to them. The government needs to do something about this. They need to make more laws. Well, you know, we wouldn't have all these problems if we had more guns, including the problem we have with the police. You know, Gary mentioned earlier about the army that was sitting within our borders itself right now, that army that our founding fathers warned us of. You know, if we look across the country at the statistics of police shootings, of unarmed people, of people that are actually in handcuffs, We just watched a young black kid get executed by a cop while he was face down on the ground, surrounded by three big burly cops, and one of them put two in his back, or one in his head and one in his back. You know, what if, when these things happened, what if that cop, all of a sudden, as soon as he fired upon that individual, all he heard was bags unzipping and hammers going back, and safeties coming off. And they, all three of those cops looked up to nothing but a subway tunnel full of pissed off Americans holding guns on them. What would they do then? What if every time one of these cops you see beating the shit out of people and there's 50, 60, 70 people just standing around watching? What if those people said enough of this shit? And what if they restrained those officers? And if the officers resisted, the people then used their right to engage in deadly force, because those cops are armed. And according to the law, if you're facing an armed opponent who is violating the law, you have the right to engage and use deadly force or enough force to stop his action. How many times do you think these cops would have to be punished by the American people like that before cops got the message? We better start being nice. We better remember who's in charge. What if our government and our police actually feared us for a change?
There would be liberty.
Now, how do we get there?
Committees.
Same way the founding fathers did. Follow their footsteps.
Here's the problem we have, though. We are disorganized. We are fragmented. We are divided, and we squabble like children. There are some good ones of us out there. There are good people out there. Do not get me wrong. Many of you listen to this show. There's 500 people that listen to this show regularly. But you have other people, like Gary mentioned a state earlier, where there's coups within the militia by the loudest talker. We have no plan. We've done 4 shows with Joseph P. Martino, retired lieutenant colonel. His specialty was insurgencies, combating insurgencies. He's taken that info, turned it around, and looked at it from the revolutionary side and said, how does somebody resist tyranny? We've talked about this. We have no plan. All four shows that we've had with him, we have discussed this in great detail. There is no plan. Well, the vast majority of people don't have a plan. There's a plan here at U of Tread on me. We got a plan. We have a plan A like we're required to have. That peaceful resolve, that olive branch petition. You can find it at the top of the website. The petition. That's all olive branch. That's the new one. And then we have plan B through Z. For as peaceful a restoration as they will allow us. But it takes action. It takes a few brave souls to actually get going and say, we've had enough. It takes people doing and forming different organizations and infrastructure in order to make it happen. What are we doing? Each day that goes by is one day closer to tyranny we get and 24 hours that we lost. Our founders planned for years before the actual war itself. And as Joe has said, every resistance organization that has ever existed that did not plan beforehand, that was not at least had a skeletal structure set up beforehand, they all failed. And even those who were well planned and had a decent infrastructure already planned out, many of them failed. Our founders didn't fail. They planned for years and years and years beforehand. They organized, they coordinated, they created that civil authority. They created their communication lines with the committees of correspondence. What are we doing? We blog, we chat, we do not much of anything. We continue to post articles for the 10th millionth time that day, that hour. We need to get this together. Otherwise, we are done. And then we're going to be faced with a whole bunch of Custer's last stands. And that's what we're going to end up as.
And if the United States goes, so does the rest of the world. We are the last bastion. We are the most armed populace in the world. We outnumber any organized military. And there's people who don't even call themselves militia or patriots. That if somebody comes kicking down their door using extreme excessive force coming for constitutionally guaranteed rights, they're going to blow them away. Those people aren't calling themselves patriots or militia. We need to harness this. People have such, I don't want to say a great pride, but people have pride in being American. And people have pride in being gun owners, not victims. What we need to do is harness this. Harness this overbearing weight that our soul carries right now as it cries out for liberty. We need to harness people's emotions and mold it into what it needs to be to make a change.
Now, Fox, you just said something about the last hope. There's something that many people don't understand about the United States, and they'll talk about the Great Seal of the United States, where it says Novus Ordo Secundum, which is the new order of the ages. They think that's evil, sinister, something from Masons or something like that. But in fact, for the first time in the history of the world, in fact, the only time in the history of the world, that a government was established peaceably by the citizens of that country was the United States of America. They went through the Continental Congresses, the Articles of Confederation, and finally the Constitution. The question Franklin had was, can they keep it? But there is no other country in the world that was ever created in such a manner as the United States. Jefferson used to think that it would be a beacon to the rest of the world, and it was for many years. Somewhere around 1860, it started going in a different direction. But the opportunity, and now you have revolutions in all these other countries, and the void is filled by the most powerful. That didn't happen here. This is the only place it didn't happen. The people, through conventions in the 13 colonies, reviewed the Constitution and ratified it. They accepted it as a form of government. They were a majority. They were not the everybody, but they were a majority. But it was an experiment. That experiment was the first and only experiment in self-government in the history of the world. Now it falls upon us, 236 years after that process began, to either redeem that man can govern himself, or give up that great experiment and prove that man cannot govern himself. So if we are willing to go back and force the government back into the chains that are supposed to bind it, the Constitution for the United States of America, we will have redeemed the work of those great people that were willing to give their lives to allow this great experiment, the new order of ages, to exist on the planet Earth. If we let down our responsibility, it may never happen again as long as man peoples this Earth, because it will have failed.
Now, I'm going to... There's Tea Party talk right now in the chat room, and I'd like to address some of that. My personal thoughts on the Tea Party, besides it being extremely political and ruined from the beginning, they seems to me like they showed up as soon as they started losing from their pocketbook. And with all due respect to any Tea Partier who might be listening in, I was a patriot before it was cool. I was in the movement before I started losing money to this government. When Bush was in power and signing all of these disgusting executive orders, and I'm really trying not to swear on the show here, and disgusting laws and all of these things, and BSing the people and lying. That's when I became a patriot. I was 19. The Tea Party showed up, and it seems like they just don't want to get taxed. Like they could care less about anything else. And that's just my personal thoughts. I have very painful association with the Tea Party, because it doesn't seem like they're out for the Constitution. All due respect. That's what I think. And that's what I got. What do you guys think?
Well, I agree with you completely. The Tea Party, now, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of people, Tea Party is very diverse. There are a lot of people in the Tea Party that are looking, as we all have at one time, for a peaceful resolution to the problem that we face in this country. There are others that were only concerned about their money. But a lot of the Tea Party people were people back in the 90s were looking for a peaceful solution. I've talked with old friends who have joined the Tea Party movement. There's a lot of new people in it as well. But what they fail to recognize is who conducted the Tea Party? The Sons of Liberty. They destroyed private property. They killed people. They stole things. They tore down houses. They tore down warehouses. They did not abide by the law. Then the Tea Party today, even though they use the term Tea Party, are the antithesis of the Tea Party. The Tea Party back then, the Sons of Liberty, were desperate to demonstrate the sincerity with which they held their beliefs. They didn't go out in the streets with signs on sticks. In Western Massachusetts, the Sons of Liberty and the militia and the people went out with rifles. So what they've done is they've stolen a name. Now, the Tea Party's very early on, one in Florida, a bunch of Democrats went down and joined the local Tea Party and took it over. And I think it finally just disappeared. A lot of the Tea Party organizations now have had infighting over who the great leader is. the local ones. I know the Phoenix Tea Party's gone through a lot of turmoil lately, and but it is a political party. If there were a political solution, it probably would have been found before I was born. But the government has passed laws and imposed themselves on us to a point where there is no way out through legal means. If you don't believe me, I'll be, you know, throw the questions out. I'll tell you why it can't work that way. But let's just say a Tea Party candidate gets elected. Now, this was theoretical when I first started telling the story. And then he goes to Washington, and he's there to change things. But he's from Iowa, and there's a dam in Iowa that needs repair. It's a federal dam. So he says, I need $1 million to repair my dam in Idaho. Okay, well, write your bill up and turn it into that committee. So he writes his bill up and turns it in that committee. A couple weeks later, he goes back to the committee, and he says, well, where's my bill? I need to get that dam fixed. Well, we're reviewing it. Don't worry, it'll come out pretty soon. A couple months later, he goes back, and he says, you know, about my bill for the dam repair money, the $1 million for dam repair. Oh yes, that's going on as a rider to the Raising the Deficit Act. Well, I'm not going to vote to raise the deficit. Oh, you're not going to vote for your own bill? And that's the way Washington works. So that guy, after his 2 years in office as a representative, is either going to have learned the ways of Washington and learned that he's going to have to trade off his integrity to get what he needs for his state, or he's going to go home after 2 years and say, I'll try and not cuss on the program too, frig it, I can't get anything done in Washington, it's impossible, it just doesn't work. And that's the nature of politics in Washington, because they have become an in-body, and one thing the Constitution sorely needed and unfortunately did not include: only the House of Representatives can punish its members. Only the Senate can punish its members. Only Congress can punish the members of the executive branch of government and the judicial branch of government through the impeachment process. They gave us nothing to hold government's feet to the fire. We have no tools except what they thought might work, called the election process. And that election process right now, I got to cuss because I don't know how to explain this one. What it amounts to is you've got the Republican Party dangling a turd on a string saying, vote for this turd. And then you've got the Democrats dangling a turd on a string. It's not cussing, is it? And saying, vote for this turd. Now, you've never heard of the turd before, or maybe you have. But you've never seen him in government for the most part. Sometimes you have. But when you're done voting, it doesn't matter if you're voting for the Republican turd or the Democratic turd. When you're done, what do you end up with? A turd. Now, what they have done is design that system so that a third party or an independent has virtually no chance of getting elected to any office of any significance in this country. It will be the dogs that have kissed the backsides, I'm still trying, the backsides of the power brokers in the political parties who finally earned their stripes and are allowed to run for any effective office or get any committee appointments in Congress. So these people are the select few that have learned to kiss backsides and obey the will of the political party. Now, the guys that run the political parties, you don't know their names for the most part, and it's not the ones that you hear. There are power brokers. I knew one in Florida years ago. Nobody ever knew his name. They didn't know what effect he had, but he had more influence than any 10,000 voters in Florida. So these power brokers pick these people that they're going to present to you dangled on a string, and that's your choice. And you believe you've got a choice when you get to vote. Yes, you do. You get this turd or that turd. The election process has been so taken over by imposition of laws that are contrary to the Constitution that we don't have a choice. We have a choice only of two turds.
Now, I can only speak for the Texas Bill of Rights because I'm not 100% on what other states mention. But if I'm not mistaken, Article 1, Section 29 of the Texas Bill of Rights says that anything that directly contradicts the Texas Bill of Rights itself is null and void immediately. Now, all of the people who claim to be constitutional scholars and lawyers, why is the Patriot Act active in the state of Texas?
How would you enforce it? Going to court?
Enforce the Texas Bill of Rights?
Yeah.
I would assume
Texas isn't enforcing it. What remedy do you have? Going to court? As an individual, what remedy do you have? Going to court? Isn't that the only... That or picking up a rifle? I mean, you got two choices. So if your remedy is going to court, and you go to court, and that court is submitted to the powers that be in Washington, then, in essence, Article 1, Section 29 is null and void. It's there on paper only, just like the one in Washington. Isn't that true, Fox?
Can't say I disagree.
Well, that's the reality of it. Your remedy is in court. The courts have submitted. The courts protect the cops. The cops protect the courts.
Who's sitting in that court with the judge?
The courts are corrupt. They do not. The Supreme Court of the United States admitted in 1937 that they do not will not act on the constitutionality of any matter before them unless they have no choice. And they list a number of ways in which they can avoid addressing the constitutionality of that matter before them, and it'll be explained in that link I just put up there, P117. That's Ashwander versus TVA. Brandy's enlightened us by telling us what policy the Supreme Court had adopted to avoid ruling on the constitutionality of matters before them. So when we hear the Supreme Court made a decision, we assume it's constitutional. But it's not. It has nothing to do with the Constitution because they found a way around ruling on the constitutionality. So let's see, the election box, the ballot box, and the jury box have just been discounted.
Soapbox has been dead for over 100 years.
Well, no, the soapbox is still alive. We're here now, except we might go to jail for what we're saying here.
Hence, the soapbox is dead.
Try me.
It's standing before is standing on the gallows, yes. And as I explained before when I posted C3CM up there, the gallows is there. They're letting us speak now, but when they want us to stop speaking, they're going to swoop down on those that speak, not bull crap, trying Fox, not bull crap, but the people that are telling you things that are true. It doesn't matter what flew into the World Trade Center. It doesn't matter what went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. It doesn't matter where Obama was born, unless you want Biden for president. What matters is there's a government that belongs to us that has been taken away from us. And those that will speak directly to that point will be the targets of the government when they really clamp down on freedom of speech.
Those will be the dangerous ones to them because those ones are cutting through all the crap. And they're pointing at the true cause of all of these problems. So instead of everybody going out there and chasing all of these little symptoms of the problem, those that are pointing to the real problem will become dangerous because they'll drag the other people, kicking and screaming if need be, away from those little problems that they think are reality and show them the real problem and then get them to do something about it. You know, but again, it comes down to this. You know, will we go quietly into that night? Will we allow ourselves to be bullied into submission? will we allow ourselves to have to be forced to stand there barricaded in our homes, holding out, engaged in a Custer's last stand because we did nothing and we did nothing beforehand? You know, let's look at a state that we, you know, I saw so many militia looking up towards and trying to get to reach that point in. Let's look at Alaska. Let's look at Schaefer Cox. Now, right or wrong, I don't know, and I really don't care what he did. The point I'm bringing up with this is, where were his militia? Where was his support from the community that he said was behind him 100%? They were nowhere. At the end, he was being kicked out from the very few people that would support him. He was being kicked out of their homes because they were afraid to help him. And that's how it will be for all of us. If you have ever stood up, if you have ever said no, if you have ever gotten on any website anywhere and said something they don't like, they will come for you. And the more vocal you've been, the more important the things that you're saying are to them or detrimental to them, the higher the list you climb. It's in your best interest to get busy. Our founding fathers got busy. They did what needed to be done. They had a plan. And for those of you who are wondering, well, where's the plan today? We have that plan here. I posted the links many times in the chat room. You can find that plan at outpost-of-freedom.com. You'll see a big link there that says blog. Go to that. And then look on the right-hand side for the tabs that say the plan for the restoration of constitutional government. And start reading. We have a plan. We have an end goal.
If it's scrolled off of the list of the most recent blogs, there is a search button there, and just type in plan constitutional government, and it'll take you to that page. There's a search button on the right side there.
There's a search button now. Sorry about that. Look for the plan. And if you want to know what the end goal of that plan is, well, that's the petition.
That's the beginning goal.
That's the beginning goal. That's our plan A, that peaceful resolve. But it's also the end goal for after we get everything fixed. Or something along this lines. It's a template that can fix our problems later, even if we go through plan B through Z. You can find that over here on the U of Tredemy on the petition. There's a link for the top of the page. Read them. They're short reads. You can get through them both in under 30 minutes. And that's reading slow. Read them. Find out what a plan really looks like. Not this end the Fed, restore gold and silver, none of that. A real plan that says what is going to happen, how it's going to happen, and what effect it will have. And what we can implement to secure our freedom from here on out, to make sure that these people are accountable to us within a moment's notice, and how we can keep this from ever happening again. And all of it is 100% constitutional.
Without committees in place, I know I've said this probably a few times on the show already, without committees in place and without cohesive constitutional militia units subordinating to those committees, we will not, this country will not survive any longer. We will fall. And with the United States, the rest of the world falls. I've been talking for the past 4 or 5 weeks now about how to create and maintain a constitutional militia unit, starting from recruiting, on to training, to maintaining leadership amongst the ranks, creating community. Randy and I and Dave and Gary are laying things out for everybody. And this is why Randy and myself were talking about this earlier. Mainstream, these people who claim to be alternative news media but who are actually mainstream will not have us on. We require you to think. We require you to act. We make no money off of anything that we do here. It's time to get your shit together. We are the last generation. I was sitting back before the show a little bit, getting things ready and lined up. Put my hands behind my head, and I heard my watch. Tick, 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 tick. Every second that we lose is another second that they gain. This is not a game. We need to get pissed off. We have everything that needs to be done, every lawful, trying to keep myself contained, forgive me. We have every lawful solution for you to take and to deliver. All you need to do is get up and do it.
Well, Fox, you said committees have to be in place, and I've got to challenge that statement. I just posted what was written on April 12th, 1 week before Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts. The committees of safety did not exist in a lot of parts of Western Massachusetts, even. They were protected by the Crown. They didn't see the need. The process of building up doesn't require a committee everywhere. When the need arises, which the provincial Congress thought existed a week before Lexington and Concord, or when Patrick Henry in March talked about give me liberty or give me death, a lot of people did not recognize the severity or did not believe it would come to blows. In fact, it was King George that said, I guess it will come to blows, or something to that effect. The reality comes when those that are pissed off and urinated off enough, to do something, and then those that are straddling the fence decide which side of the fence they're going to get on. So they need not all be in place, but the resolve has to be there, the commitment to the cause. And when the SHTF, then people will take that last step that they've been talking about for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. So they don't need to be in place, but we need to be moving in that direction. And that's what's so important. You need to form committees of safety to look out for hurricanes, earthquakes, man-made disasters. Start planning. Get your community organized. If not now, when the shooting starts, you better move quickly. But the best time to start is now. Randy has picked up my favorite Chinese proverb. What's the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago. What's the second best time? Today. There is no third best time. If you want to sit under that tree and enjoy the shade, you'd better plant it.
Well, you know what? You know, here's a great way to sell the committees of safety. And here's a proven, modern, right now, current example of how they worked. Hurricane Rita hit Texas. And there was a guy down there named Leighton Wyman. And when this hurricane hit, when Rita hit his area, man, it was bad. And the first thing Leighton did is he started going out there and he started organizing people. And eventually what happened was they ended up with a militia, an armed body. They ended up with a civil authority. They had a group of people that were acting as the coordinators of everything. They began putting out food, purifying water. They blocked off both entrances to their street because they were having problems with looters and thugs and gangs. They had roaming patrols and rotating patrols. They had a command bunker. They had a command area set up in a garage. And 1 month later, approximately, the first cop showed up. And he saw the barricades, and he saw the street blocked off, and he saw the armed men out there. And he saw people moving between house and house. And he saw people doing things. And he went up and he started talking to them. And he asked what was going on. And they told, and Layton and them told them what they were doing. And why. And the cop said, good to hear. I'll let everybody else know we don't have to worry about this area. Layton told that story on a post that was done about committees of safety on well-regulated American militia. And he didn't realize until recently that what he did is he had formed a committee, is that they had formed a committee of safety. And they had formed, and he knew they had formed their militia, but they had formed that committee of safety, and they didn't realize, and it didn't dawn on him until recently what they had done and how effective it had been. That's how you sell that. You can find his story at Well-Regulated American Militia. If anybody wants a copy of it, I'll be more than happy to shoot him over a cut-and-paste copy. I asked Layton if I could shoot it out. He said, yes. So, if you're not on RAM or you don't want to join RAM or whatever, fine. Hit me up in an email, randymack@uofTreadomy.com. We also have a bunch of files put together for us that you can burn to CD explaining the committees of safety from A to Z in a very logical, easy-to-understand way. Both audio and written. If you'd like those files, get in touch with me. You can email me at randymack@uofTreadomy.com and we'll get them to you. You can also start handing those out. That's an easy way to get people to start understanding and reading. So, also, before the show ends, the only bit of consumerism I promote here, at the top of the page at the website on uofTreadomy.com, and I say this every damn show, there's a link there in bright yellow letters. It says Resistance to Tyranny. That's Joe's book. That book that we keep talking about, that every militia member out there should own, that every committee of safety should have numerous copies on file, on hand, to hand out to let people read. And if it was my choice, there would be a law that I would pass. Every American would own a gun, and every American would own that book, just in case. Check out the book. Buy that book. Read that book. Absorb that book. And start thinking about how to implement in your area.
If you are a committee of safety or a militia and you don't have that book, you are not prepared for anything.
All right. Well, we're at the top of the hour here, folks. Looks like we're going to start winding down. Gary, go ahead and fire off a couple websites. People looking for resources, looking to get a hold of you, anything that you want to put out there.
Well, www.outpost-of-freedom.com. Some of the more important articles are right at the top of that page. There's also a link to the blog on that page. If you go to the blog and want to talk about, look up any, there's a search box. If you want to look up Ashwander, the case I spoke of, Ashwander, type that in the search box and it'll show any articles, any blogs that have that article. The plan, the same thing. We need to learn our history. We need to know where we're going. As Randy keeps pointing out, and I will point out, because 20 years active in the Patriot community, from 1993, from Waco on, I've been very active in the Patriot community. My intention, as is all of ours, is to restore constitutional government. That's an ambiguous goal, restore constitutional government. The plan for the restoration of constitutional government that Randy has referred to and I've referred to, and it lays out the plan. It has the steps on the way and what's to be accomplished in each step and what the ultimate goal is. And that is to restore constitutional government. And in the meantime, while doing that, giving teeth that I mentioned earlier, some recourse for us against the people in the House of Representatives, the people in the Senate, the people in the executive branch, and the people in the judicial branches of government. We have nothing now except voting for two of those branches and not voting for the third to hope to try and return to constitutional government. We have no teeth. An oversight of the founders, addressed in the ratification conventions, but never anything done about it. We need those teeth, and they're part of the plan. They will be installed, and we will be able to bite back when they try and take our freedoms away again. And thank you for listening.
Before we close out, I want to let everybody know, Dave just let me know that right after this broadcast, we are going to be rebroadcasting the four episodes with Joe Martino entitled Resistance to Tyranny, where we start getting into his book, into his vast study of insurgencies and counterinsurgency. And what he says is the only way and everything you will need to resist tyranny with any chance of succeeding. And this is what this man did. In the military, this is all he did for a very, very long time. This is all he did. So we're going to be restreaming those four audios. They're available for download as well. All of our archives are. So stick around, listen to those shows. I'm telling you, I go back and I re-listen to those shows regularly just because. I've read his book 13 times in less than 4 months. Most important book you'll ever read. One of them, anyways. So that's all I got to say, other than be safe and be free, everyone. What you do today matters. Make it happen.
Alrighty, and this Saturday, same time, 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, I have Major Cross of the Ohio Minuteman Militia coming on, talking about maintenance of command. So be sure to tune into that. Randy's got his shows at the same times on Sunday and Monday. Who do you got coming on, Randy?
This Sunday, what do I have? I have this Sunday, the hard questions again, man. I've been so busy getting with the Committee of Safety Common Law Court. This is odd. I can't seem to remember my damn shows. What are we looking at? The 24th? Actually, this 24th, I've got a group coming on, out of Portland. This gentleman coming on he's out of Portland, or out of the Oregon area. He's militia oriented. He's active in the militia community as well, but he's trying to put together a protest, a counter protest to the Sharia law protest that's going on in D.C. But I don't bring those people on normally. But after talking with him for 2 hours and him absorbing the information that I was giving him, he agreed they had no plan. They had no plan for teeth. Nothing they were doing was going to be effective. So he guaranteed me that by the time he came on the show, he would have an effective action plan with teeth to do before, during, and after that protest, and a way for people to engage in it on a local level as well, instead of just being able to, just having to be forced to go to D.C. That protest is on the 4th of July, so we're going to be having him on this coming Sunday, and next Monday we are going to do I don't know what. I forgot to be honest with you, but I'll put it out in an email. If you're not on the email list, you can get on the email list for the show updates, the shows that we put out each week. I don't send out garbage. I don't send out forwards. I don't send out junk mail. I just send out the show info. You can contact me at randymack@youhavetreadonme.com. But I'll get the show info out here probably in the next day or two for the upcoming shows. And I've got a surprise show coming up. I've got a special guest coming on. He was accused of kidnapping, torturing, doing all kinds of nasty stuff to illegal immigrants a while back. His name is Casey Nethercott. He was acquitted of all the charges, yet he lost his ranch when the SPLC sued him. Jan Brewer and the Arizona State Legislature just passed an emergency bill for him and for everybody like him that comes afterwards and possibly beforehand to get their land back or to take it out of the SPLC's butt. The bill was just signed. So we're going to be talking to him about that. And he's got some big plans coming up for things he's going to do in Arizona now, especially with the money he's getting from the SPLC with this bill passing. So we're going to have him coming up next week sometime. I think Actually, I'm sorry, this week sometime. I think possibly Thursday or Friday. So I'll get that in the email as well when we get the date finalized.
Outstanding. Gary, Randy, thank y'all for coming on. I always appreciate having you guys on.
Well, thanks for the invite.
Thank you for doing the show, by the way, as well. Thank you. No, seriously, thank you for doing this show. You know what? It slipped my mind. You know, I've been so busy with the committee of Safety Common Law Court that I completely forgot that April 19th was around the corner. So I want to thank you, Fox, for remembering this day and thinking about doing this show.
You're very welcome, Randy.
Thanks for having us on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I like having you guys on. You're very useful. Speaking about solutions. That's what we need to do, and that's why I want you guys on more. So I'm going to close everybody out by saying a quote from Captain John Parker on Lexington Green 236 years ago. Stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have a war, then let it begin here. Stay frosty, everybody.
Be safe, be free.